Hi, and welcome to the Data Engineering Podcast, hosted by Cynthia. I'm Jason Gould. I'll be looking after the discussion every week. We'll cover a host of topics like DevOps and tooling, programming languages, and strategies, and all that kind of stuff. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy it. Hopefully, we'll catch you next time. Hello, and welcome to the Data Platform Podcast.
With me, as always, or new, as always, still new, aren't you, really, is Eva. And we have a special guest with us today. We have Pete from Elemental, as CEO. Very exciting. And you want to introduce yourself, Pete?
Hey, I'm Pete. I'm the CEO here at Elemental. I actually joined the company last year to be the head of engineering and transitioned to CEO in November of last year, which has been really exciting and a lot of fun.
Cool. So tell us about Elemental. What do you do?
We make DAGs.
Tell our listeners, because we already know.
All right, fair enough. So we make Dagster, which is an open source data orchestration tool. So you can kind of think of it as a library or framework for building and operating data pipelines. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, every organization, once they hit a certain scale and a smaller scale than you would normally think, they make critical decisions based on data, right? And so they're often moving data around, transforming it in some way. And in order to kind of coordinate all the different tools in the stack, you need a data orchestrator like Dagster to manage that complexity. So we build an open source project that does that for you. And then we also have a cloud service we basically host it for you. And we have a bunch of additional features that, large and small organizations both really like.
Cool. So a little bit more, because today's topic is going to be about orchestration. So I'm just going to add a little bit for people who aren't familiar with Dagster. You could maybe think of it as it's a cooler, friendlier, offers more functionality, effective version of Airflow, really, because everybody knows what Airflow is.
Yeah. So Airflow is definitely the most common, orchestration tool that people use for this. We like to think that we're first of all like a better Airflow, but more importantly, evolving the category.
Yeah.
So we think that kind of workflow orchestration as it's currently articulated is not really what people need. And they need basically an evolution of that category, and that's what we're trying to deliver.
Cool. So as mentioned, today's topic is orchestration. And we're going to get into, what you can do with it, typical use cases, that kind of stuff, where it needs to go, whether or not orchestration is the right thing for you, whether or not re-architecting to avoid it is. And it's funny because I mentioned we had a chat last week before you came on, and I mentioned that I'd heard a talk on orchestration. And half the use case, I was sat there thinking, but orchestration is not solving your underlying problem. It's allowing you to do your job, but it's not solving the underlying issue. And maybe we touch on some of those things a little bit.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, Eva, what's orchestration?
Okay. Well, I had a privilege of working, let's say, with another open source orchestrator. And I primarily used it to actually construct data pipelines because I am a data engineer, so I had to orchestrate my tasks, let's say. And it was really important for me to also be able to see the execution of the pipelines, and also if something breaks, to be able to actually retry certain steps. So, and also when you have an orchestrator or let's say a central point like that, you can actually see all of your data flows in one central place and have the overview of, let's say, your data landscape as such. And I think that is one of the main purposes of an orchestrator at this point, because as Pete also mentions, there are a lot of different tools. Also as data engineers or anyone that's working with data, there are tools emerging daily, and basically we need to be able to understand what is happening with our data and our pipelines. So that's primarily why we are using orchestrators, let's say, in Syntio.
So if we then break that down for the less technical people in our audience, I include myself in that list.
Okay.
We can look at an orchestrator. I mean, effectively as a data engineer, or to enable getting the value from the data, what we want to do is we want to bring data from a source, and that might be a sales tool or a marketing tool or a whatever it might be, and we want to bring that data. We maybe want to bring data from several sources, hence the reason need for an orchestrator. You need to bring tool from this source, then this source, then this source, and make sure you have all of that stuff before you can aggregate it in order to get the value out of it. So you want to have a look at, for example, let's think, you know, if you've got click data from Google, for example, you might want to combine that with completed orders so you can see where you're losing customers, for example. So do some analytics around that, maybe have a better recommendation engine, whatever it is you might want to do to address people leaving baskets, for example. Would that be fair?
Yeah, you know, I think I totally agree with you. I would say the first, could I nitpick you a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Please do.
So the way that we think about it, you know, at Elemental and as part of the Dagster community, is that data engineering is not actually necessarily like a job title or even a function in the organization. It's like a role or a discipline that multiple people within the organization, you know, participate in, right? And so there are people with the title of data engineer and data platform engineer. But there are also people with the title of like machine learning engineer, for example, right? Which has historically been siloed off into a different organization, maybe even using different tools and a different stack. But fundamentally, if you talk to those folks that are practicing, you know, machine learning engineering, they are fundamentally building data pipelines. They're often collaborating on the same data sets that the rest of the organization is working on. So, you know, I think that some people who are participating in the process that you just described are building dashboards. You might call them the analytics team. Other are building predictive models, right? And they're saying, hey, you know, we're gonna have to order this many widgets to put in the warehouse because our Google Clickstream data, you know, shows that we're gonna, you know, when joined with our inventory data, you know, we can predict how many sales we're gonna have next week and what we need to do in order to kind of like, you know, fulfill those orders, you know, moving forward. So it's a diverse set of folks that are working on this in this domain.
Yeah, I mean, I know we sort of say data engineers a lot, but as you mentioned, you know, the ML ops especially is becoming a huge another job title, and then you're going to have AI's going to quickly ramp up, and everything will change again. And I mean, at the end of the day, these guys and girls are all software engineers. Mm-hmm. With a focus on a particular area, and I have to be honest, I agree with you 100%. It's becoming more difficult to differentiate between where the responsibilities lay, especially, you know, when we look at, you know, data mesh and all of the DevOps stuff that goes on. I, for many years, got really upset with the DevOps title. It's like, no, it's an infrastructure engineer.
Yeah, I'm why you were upset with that title? Because I have my own beefs with it too. I'm curious.
It's probably the same thing. It's just like, well, you know, but DevOps isn't really a thing. It's an you have an infrastructure engineer, you have a software engineer, and DevOps is a concept. but yeah. DevOps sounds cooler, apparently.
Yeah, you know, I think. I do use the term from time to time because I think there are certain, like, you know, technologies and techniques and best practices in the orbit that get the DevOps label, the meaning of DevOps label slapped on it, but are useful to talk about. So like CI/CD, for example, there are organizations that value it and there are organizations that don't, and the ones that value it, you know, look very differently, I think, than the ones that don't.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we work with a lot that don't.
Oh, yeah.
Typically. So anyway, back to our orchestration topic. I mean, Eva mentioned it right at the very start. There are a whole bunch of tools.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many different ways of getting data, so many tools with data in them, so many different database types. You know, Pete, when you're putting all of this stuff together, how do you decide what integration to do next? How do you decide what to integrate with? Because it's got to be pretty complex. You integrate with so many things.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, to the answer with respect to integrations is like, we talk to our users and we're leaned in really heavily in the community. We use our own product. And so we're constantly talking to users, whether they're open source or they are commercial. And we just kind of hear what technologies they're using and what problems they need to solve. And so, you know, we have a lot, like DBT is our most popular integration, DBT Core. You know, Fivetran and Aerobyte and these other like ETL tools are you know, another category of integration that's quite popular for us. And that makes sense, right? Because you need to like ingest data, transform it and put it somewhere. And then stitching those tools together is really where Dagster or another data orchestrator comes in. And, you know, we think that, you know, as we start to kind of go down the list of integrations, you know, we look at our telemetry, we talk to our users, and we make sure that, you know, it aligns with what they're trying to do. So we take a very like user-centric approach. I would say that we have a pretty strong point of view of where we think orchestration should go as a category. And that I would say is that's a little more of a synthesis between like kind of like our internal strategy and what we're hearing from customers. You know, like a mistake startups often make is they like just 100% listen to customer feedback, or they 100% ignore their customers. And I think it's important to like have like, you know, you want like a vision for what you're trying to do. And you want that grounded in customer feedback, but you don't want to just kind of like optimize to the local maxima or like go off into like, you know, crazy town.
Field of dreams.
Right. Exactly. If you just stay in your, you know, in your office or apartment all day, like writing code, not talking to anybody, you know, at some point you might build something cool, but like, it might not be something that anybody else finds useful. So we try to balance those. But with respect to integrations, we're a little more user driven, right? Like we talk to our users, hey, what do you need? And we go and deliver that. That's a little more kind of user driven.
So one of the things that we sort of focus quite heavily on is the data mesh concepts and all that kind of stuff. Do you see an impact on what the users are doing as that's starting to be adopted across companies? Or is it, you know, how's that impacting what you're being asked for?
Yeah. So that's, we, you know, internally, and I think we've talked about this externally a bit too. We talk a lot about software engineering best practices, you know, and we originally started the project because we saw, you know, widely deployed systems like Airflow and others. And, you know, they were solving a problem for users, but they had a lot of developer experience issues. And when you dig in, it's because they kind of had first mover disadvantage where they like built a thing, it solved the customer problem, and then they got kind of committed to that way of solving the problem because of all the momentum in the market. It becomes kind of hard for them to pivot and fix the mistakes of the past. So there's actually kind of like a second mover advantage in this category, I think. And, you know, I had previously been, you know, founding member of the React team, and we were like a second or third mover in the JS space, and we were able to really take advantage of that. And I think that you're seeing that in orchestration. These second and third movers have systems that, you know, are, you know, I think they have like, you know, higher NPS score, as they say, from their users. But we're really laser focused on software engineering best practices. And, you know, you could call that like DevOps best practices or data ops or ML ops, or you could even call it like data mesh, right? Like there's this underlying theme of like, there's a lot of complexity in the data platform, and we need to use software engineering best practices in a scalable way to manage that complexity. And so there's a real emphasis on, you know, empowering a single data engineer, or data engineer, remember, is somebody that practices data engineering, not necessarily the title of data engineer. You empower them to deliver something end to end as much as possible, right? And so they don't have to talk to 20 different teams in order to ship their pipeline. They can just do it all themselves, or as much as possible. And then there's also kind of a, you know, if that is your goal, you end up adopting a lot of the DevOps and software engineering best practices that we've talked about. Again, you know, these best practices that are in the orbit of DevOps, because DevOps means whatever, you know, the vendor wants it to mean. You know, CI/CD and testing and observability, these are all things that if you were to just empower your, you know, your engineers to ship things end to end without really nailing down these important kind of quality controls, you're going to have a really bad time. And you've seen this with a lot of organizations, you know, during their digital transformation, they like roll out microservices without the, you know, the relevant or the required really like, you know, observability, testing, monitoring, all that stuff. And you see a similar thing in data organizations where if they roll this out too quickly without good tooling and investing in centralized tooling, it can become a big mess.
So you're touching all of the things that make me wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night, because these are the things I harp on about all the time. I sort of sit there and I think, you know, but all of this stuff. So microservice transformation was never going to work. It's gonna give you some benefit, but it's never gonna help your organization as much as the people trying to sell you the consulting around it tell you it's going to.
Yes.
Because you're decoupling the front end is going to give you some acceleration. But until you've decoupled the back end, you're not going to get the full benefit. And I look at all of the ways that we're doing stuff. And this is, I take you back to the conversation we had before for when I heard the talk on orchestration, and I'm saying, but you're solving a problem we shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying, you know, you can't wave a magic wand and fix everything nice and prettily and all the rest of it. You know, we're dealing with software vendors that sell, I'm not going to mention any names in particular, but they make gigantic ERP systems. Those guys don't like to share data with anyone. Mm-hmm. What they want to do is sell you the module that does the job you want inside their ecosystem. Right. So they deliberately obfuscate data to make it tough to get stuff out. And in some cases, even license you against getting data out. And I look at all of these things going on and I'm thinking, this is why we have such a big problem, not just in the sort of data pipeline arena, but right across the tech stack in every organization. And this is why we end up with tools that solve problems for engineers that need to get their job, day job done. But, yeah, you know, nobody's sort of looking at the bigger picture of why do I have this problem in the first place?
Yeah, well, I like to think that we're looking at it, you know, in a fairly deep way. Like, you know, when you start a company, you got to have a problem to solve.
Oh yeah, sure.
And so when Nick Schrock started it, you know, a couple of years ago, he actually wanted to go build like tools that help solve like real, you know, big society important level problems. Like he wanted to like cure cancer and stuff like that. And then when he did the diligence in these categories, he kept kind of like, the feedback he kept getting was like, yeah, that's all great, but like the scientists are doing fine. They just can't manage their data pipelines. They break all the time and nobody can figure out like why the data is stale. And like there was this underlying kind of problem with how data was managed, which is why the company was started. And so I think you bring up a really interesting point, which is how much of this is like accidental self-inflicted complexity, potentially because, you know, we dumped billions of dollars of VC into this category to sell you a bunch of products, versus how much of this is essential complexity, like just fundamental to the space. And I think that it's a mix, to be honest, you know, so it's, you could start out with like the pristine single data warehouse, but you know, that works great. Even if you're the most disciplined engineering organization in the world, the instant you buy another company, like you're screwed, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, once you hit a certain scale, even with all the best practices in the world, I mean, true best practices, not ones that are like sold to you by vendors. Like you're still going to run into these like really complex heterogeneous environments. You know, you do a big, like if a big layoff were to happen, which you're seeing, you know, you've been seeing over the last couple of quarters, right. You know, there's a huge loss of institutional knowledge that happens. Mm. And then these systems become like actually really hard to maintain because people get afraid to like make potentially breaking changes and clean up the legacy code. And so you end up then with like the V1 pipeline, which is critical to the business. Then you evolve the V2 pipeline. The V2 pipeline becomes business critical for like half of the functionality, but you just can't figure out how to deprecate the V1 pipeline entirely. So you're stuck with it forever. And you know, I mean, I don't know if this is resonating with you all, but it's,
All of it. It's really funny because, as I say, I work a lot with advising companies on transformation, and this is all of the stuff I talk about: the building of technical and organizational debt, the fact that, you know, you when you look at the decision making that goes on with an organization, most of the decision making in gigantic organizations is not made for the benefit of the organization. It's made for the benefit of the manager that owns totally. In inverted commas, that system, because what they, you know, it's really hard to look at a system of disjointed, disconnected things and identify where the value really comes from. Mm-hmm. So as an organization, you don't necessarily pay people for the value they produce. You pay people by the perception of the value. And what companies do is they look at that and say, well, this guy has 500 engineers working for him and he's responsible for a budget of $1 billion. Therefore, he must be super important. We'll give him more money. That's mm-hmm. how we'll remunerate him. Where the reality is, he's probably costing you money.
Yeah. Man, this is a great topic. Connective incentives between like the individuals and the organization. It's like, you know, I feel like a new leader, like a new director or manager or something, a manager of managers. Mm. It's like, you know how when you go to prison, you're supposed to like beat somebody up the first day so nobody messes with you? I feel like if you join a new organization as a director, you have to reorg. Like, even if the org structure is working great, you got to reorg, because otherwise you don't have enough of a reputation to last.
Yeah. So I have a really cool one with reorgs. Reorgs work really well for making companies efficient for a short space of time. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that most you have a huge amount of organizational debt in your processes and procedures. When you do a reorg, nobody knows who they need to tell they've done this job, so they just get on with it, and they're therefore really efficient until you introduce all the processes and procedures again to slow them all down, because it's funny, psychology is great, it's a great topic. Anyway, this isn't solving our orchestration issues, although it is a fantastic topic.
Well, I think it is actually relevant, right? Because fundamentally, like, organizations are made up of people, and, you know, they say there are all these phrases about culture eating strategy for breakfast and stuff like that. And I don't know, have you heard that?
Yeah.
If you have a great,
I've used it. Culture, right? I've used it.
Oh yeah. Okay. Cool. So you have a great company culture. You know, your strategy doesn't need to be that good because your execution or may not need to be that good because your execution can often outweigh it because of the cultural factors, right? You know, these really fast moving, high quality cultures versus the ones that require endless bureaucracy or whatever it is, whatever the right set of trade-offs is for the category. I think that like tooling really influences culture as well. Like the medium that you place people in, and especially in this area of remote work, like, you know, companies spend like millions of dollars designing the perfect collaborative office space, but then they're like, Slack is a complete mess, and they're like, virtual collaboration spaces are really messy, right? And so I think the tooling actually really influences how you collaborate. And so, you know, one of the things that orchestration, I think, really ties into this is, or the way that orchestration ties into this is that it's fundamentally like a multiplayer thing, right? Like if you're just a single person shop, that is, you know, one person building a handful of data pipelines, you can probably get away with like a cron scheduler for that. I mean, unless your pipelines are really complex, you really, when you get to complex pipelines that cut across all these different organizations, like that's when you start to need this single pane of glass, as we like to say in venture-backed vendor land, that kind of unifies the whole data platform into like one place where you can see like what's going on. And like the way that this concretely manifests itself is like, and I've had this at previous jobs too, business stakeholder calls you up. This has happened in this is a specific example from previous job. Hey, EU regulator from this region has asked us if we're deleting this data properly. Are we? And then you like, you've got this, some organizations that actually use kind of like modern tooling can like open up their data catalog or open up their orchestrator and answer that question like very, in a very straightforward way. The organizations that don't adopt that tooling it's like a multi-week exploration across Python scripts and Bash scripts and, you know, some sort of ancient Hadoop job that everybody forgot about. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So I think that, you know, having really good tooling can solve a lot of organizational problems and like actually reduce the amount of like mandatory collaboration to solve these things. You know, like I think collaboration is like good when you opt into it, but if you absolutely have to collaborate to solve a problem, it can actually slow you down because, you know, you have to wait to get your ticket into the next sprint for the other team. And that can, those delays can kind of compound.
So if you go back and listen to every podcast, and I'm glad we're able to shoehorn this one into this one, we say this all the time, the best way to manage a dependency is to remove it. Decoupling software is by far the best way to get speed in your organization and enable that small pizza-sized team to be able to do their work without having to collaborate with everyone else on the planet in order to do something, you know, tickle the dinosaur over here and the tail wags over there of approach. And it's really funny. So for me, for the last sort of 20 minutes or so, we have just effectively described the psychology of an organization to say why orchestration tools are important. All of the things we just said are the reasons why you need to orchestrate stuff, because you built up a business over time. You have different personalities running different parts of the business. The business has different needs. They will have chosen different technologies at specific times. I mean, you look at some of these organizations, they're running systems still from the 70s. Or in fact, if it's a financial organization in the UK, they're running software from the 50s. So when you put all of this together, there is no way in a giant organization with thousands of applications that, you know, you can turn around and go, so tomorrow it's all going to be event driven and we're going to publish the data and it'll be on this message broker, because it's just not feasible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's true. I think, path dependency is a huge problem to solve in you know, organizations that have been around longer than like a year, right? Mm. You know, that is great that you have this great vision for the end state, but like, how do we actually get there in practice? Mm. That is really the secret. And the other thing that I think ties into that too, that I just want to like get on my soapbox about like tail latency when it comes to project management. So if you do any monitoring of distributed systems, right? Like if you've got like some sort of microservice, you're pretty rarely looking at the median latency, because that doesn't really describe the average user experience. You look at the tail latency, like the P90, P99 latency, because, you know, if a page load takes, you know, 100 microservice RPCs to materialize the page, you know, chances are one of them will hit that like 99th percentile latency. So you want to know what that number is before you and really track that rather than drive down the median. Mm. And I think one mistake that organizations make all the time is when they're reorging or when they're working on roadmaps or when they're doing any sort of like resource allocation, they are optimizing for that median project. And I think they should be optimizing for that P99 project, right? And so you want to do this decoupling. And you also want to look ahead in the future and be like, okay, are we going to have a project that cuts across all of these different teams or some subset of these teams is going to require like a huge amount of collaboration in the future? And like, let's make sure that we plan for that. And so we want to decouple the teams as much as possible, except for maybe this one little piece of functionality where we actually want to unify the teams on like a single platform. So like, you know, a classic example is the ID space. So, you know, if everybody's building a different, owns a different set of data assets or different set of microservices or whatever it is that you're doing in engineering, if we can all at least agree on like what the primary keys are, we can collaborate in the future, right? And like that maybe is a thing that's worth getting a big annoying committee together to answer up front. And then everybody else can kind of like decouple and go and run their separate ways. You know what I mean?
And right up until the minute you buy another company.
Exactly. And then you're screwed. But at least we've got a couple of good years that we can all look back on and, you know, keep our swag t-shirts or whatever and look fondly upon those days.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because we've been looking at data catalogs a little bit as well for one of our clients, and trying to say, you know, what kind of stuff do you need to put? What kind of information do you need to put in there, metadata around the data? And I said, and I just sort of said, you know, you need to put in, you need to be able to reverse engineer the data that's in there. Because if you need to, got two companies, in this case, they have like 18 with this particular client. And I said, none of you are calculating profit in the same way. So these guys need to know how you're calculating profit so that when we bring all the data together, we can calculate everything in the same way. And it was quite interesting, the process to go through of trying to describe the data in such a way that you can reverse engineer all of the calculations that we used to make it. And I think that for me actually then became more important than making everything the same. Was saying, if you can describe it really well, you don't need to make it the same. Because they wanted to go through a process of standardization and rationalization. And I said, for what reason? Because as long as you know how you got to that, then you can reverse engineer it. And you're just going to waste a whole bunch of money trying to standardize everything for what benefit? Because as soon as you buy another company, you have to do it all again.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's... I like to say also getting a good set of tests in place also really helps in this department too. You know, at a previous employer, we eventually had to do like a rewrite of the system. But like one of the big benefits was like getting the tests in place first, so we could actually just check parity between the two systems. And it kind of speaks to what you're talking about, right? Like it doesn't. You know, you can actually duplicate the functionality in multiple places across multiple platforms, because often you have to, because they are fundamentally different technologies, but they're computing similar metrics. Mm-hmm. But as long as you have those definitions written out, and even better would be a way to kind of check to make sure that the data does line up. You know, that's really important too.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I mean, every single company, as you say, that's been around for more than 5 minutes and has more than three people in it has these problems.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take that back. Is if it has more than one person in it working for a year, it'll have these problems. I mean, you know, even with one person, you're going to start getting these issues.
Yeah. And, you know, I think people generally kind of forget how their code works like a year later. Ish, if they're working on a wide variety of stuff.
Sooner.
Those are people with really good memories, because I can't remember that far. I've looked at stuff before and gone, what lunatic wrote this code? Scrolled to the top and, oh, it was me six months ago.
So, yeah, I mean, if I can, like, complain about orchestration a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
Because it does tie into that, right? Which is, like, one of the issues, you know, I mentioned that, you know, we're trying to evolve the category. And I think one of the big problems with it is it's all about workflows. Mm. And workflows basically are very flexible and almost too flexible, right? They're basically these black box tasks that are organized and run on a schedule. And you know, within those tasks, it's actually pretty difficult to introspect what's going on, right? And so your set of best practices can diverge. And you get this like real lack of standardization. You see this in Airflow world a lot, right? Like different teams use Airflow in different ways. And there's just like a huge divergence in how teams use the tool. And so you can't just like drop a data engineer into a new team and like have them be like immediately productive, because the idioms that people use, like a lot of times they also write like abstraction layers on top that are like bespoke and special to the specific company or tool. And so, you know, one of the things that we are trying to solve by evolving the category is like standardizing the best practices too. And so that's we talk a lot about software-defined assets or data assets as like the central unifying abstraction. And like that's why we're pushing that, right? It's like we want to standardize this notion where like everybody thinks in terms of assets and can see the asset graph and how it fits together. You know, you're going to be much more productive when you're moving people between teams or getting started on a new project or even revisiting something that you wrote a year ago, right? So that's kind of where we're coming from in that respect.
I mean, actually, this aligns really well, because we talk about business objects, because at the end of the day, and I think there's a lot of if you're quite a distance away from the customer as an engineer, you're not really thinking about them. You're thinking about the cool tech stuff I'm doing and it has an outcome and everything else, but you really don't envisage the value of it. And it's a conversation I have quite a bit of saying, well, guys, you know, but you're here to provide value for the business. That's what you enable. And I think that gets forgotten about quite a lot. And when we look at this kind of abstracting all of the technology away, at the end of the day, you're left with the data. And the business object being the core thing, with its context, obviously, because customer to one department in a company is very different to customer in another department in a company. You know, if you're selling something or delivering something, your view of the customer is very different from the guys in finance.
Right.
So when we look at that sort of business object, then, of course, the definition of that business object is platform, technology, structure, almost independent. And that makes it super easy to share that information around your organization as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hopefully with the same primary key.
Hopefully with the same primary key. Yeah. I mean, it's great when you go to a logger that they can't even, you know, agree on a telephone number format. And it's like, guys, this is set by the government, really.
Yep. There's a lot of benefits to that approach. You know, you call them business objects, we call them assets, but same thing.
Yeah. Same. So Eva, as an engineer yourself, what's the super important stuff that you need to be considering with orchestration? You know, what do you do? What's your day job look like when you're doing all this stuff?
A day job as an engineer
in orchestration, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really depends what are you actually solving. It could be, let's say, an ingestion pipeline that later turns on into also transforming the data and storing it for other consumers. And also, it really depends on how different pipelines interact with each other. You know, you have several data sources that you need to ingest before you can actually, let's say, transform and get your end result that can be shared with other consumers. So basically, it is in this sense, if we focus, for example, on Airflow, it's basically programming DAGs and tasks and putting them all together. Whereas if you're looking at some more lightweight workflows such that are offered on some cloud environments, these are actually, they consist of, let's say, invoking several microservices or always pushing down your processing to, let's say, lightweight functions that you have created. So in sense, we have to code a lot of things if we want to execute some orchestration with these lighter workflow tools. So it really depends on the tooling that you use and also the task that you need to solve. But in a sense, you actually want to have a complete pipeline that can deliver the end result for others to actually consume. I think that this was really technical. You guys were talking on a different layer all the time, and I hope that our listeners will be able to understand what I've just said. But yeah, that's basically what I have to solve, and it involves a lot of coding. Sometimes it is repetitive, and that's why we, as Pete mentioned, had to come up with a special framework, which actually allows us to do our jobs easier and faster and better. And this is only because we realize that we have repetitive problems that we need to solve, and there's no benefit of us doing everything from scratch all the time. So we come up with different libraries and such that can be used again and again. So, yeah.
Not reinventing the wheel.
Exactly.
So we've had a look at the problem, which is, you know, people. it's evolution is typically the issue with this. You know, everybody has different needs. Intersection
of people and money, maybe.
Yeah. Always the biggest problem. So, you know, typically this is, different technologies bring together. We started looking at data in a different way as well. I mean, I didn't consider company-wide data and bringing lots of different data points together that you might think initially are unrelated. And I think that's added a huge layer of complexity to a lot of organizations that wasn't there you know, 20 years. I mean, I don't know if we could have done all of this stuff 20 years ago to start with, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of look at the last decade or so as the era of big data, where everybody thought they were going to be the next, like, Facebook or Google. And so we rolled out these, like, data warehouses and data lakes and these kind of, you know, MapReduce being, like, the first iteration of this. Where now everybody can compute on basically an infinite set of data for fairly cheaply. And then, like, when you solve, like, one problem in the stack, it, like, creates a whole bunch of new problems, like, the layer above it in the stack. And so now you're seeing people take advantage of all that capability, right? And so they do, you know, ELT, right? Which is, that's kind of like a data, not really a data lake, it's like a data swamp or a data junkyard.
Swamp is good, yeah.
Yeah, they just like dump everything into these storage systems and then let the like data teams figure it out later, right? And that, yeah, like creates a lot of problems with this complexity and you know, you need a bunch of tools to solve it, and then that can create more or less complexity depending on how they interact. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
No, I mean, it's one of those where we go back to what we were saying earlier about creating complexity in the law of unintended consequences, because the data swamp that is production's absolutely relying on today is, you know, oh, it's a really cool solution and everything else, but it is definitely tomorrow's problem. And now you're going to be sat there going, oh, how do we turn that off? How do we stop using that? And it's impossible. I mean, it's really funny how everything comes in cycles, because we were talking about DevOps, and I keep going back to, well, I started writing software in the 90s, which basically meant we were doing DevOps. You had to, because
it's nobody else.
There wasn't anyone else. There was no distributed cloud or anything else. You had a project team and they did everything. It's quite funny. How it everything funny how goes around and comes around.
Yeah, it's funny how these cycles play out. You're seeing this in like front end world too, where you know, it's coming. It's every 10 years they flip between, like, you know, server rendering and client rendering and stuff like that.
We used to use microservices back in the 90s because we didn't have the computing power to do anything else.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, if you can't tell, I'm a fairly big microservices hater. You know, it's like we have this, I can go to Amazon and like rent a box with like 64 CPUs and a terabyte of RAM. And like, why wouldn't we want to use this? You know what I mean? This is like magic. It's really cool. Like all the capabilities that we have today. That's why I think like what DuckDB is doing is kind of cool. The notion of kind of bringing back computing on a single node, I don't think it's going to solve everybody's problems. I think there's like, you know, there's that last 1% of your job you have to do where you actually do have to compute on big data that truly doesn't fit on a single box. And I think that it's, you know, obviously not going to work in that case, but I think there's a lot of new capabilities that it opens up.
So I think, I mean, we were getting onto orchestration, and I think we covered psychology quite well. So we're going to have to market this episode as a psychological damaging one. And I think we've sort of covered, I mean, that literally is. It is the reason why we need orchestration. But maybe what we'd do is we'd write a little paper. If you want to be involved on that, we'll put something out about Dagster specifically on its use and everything else. We'll put some links up on our website for that as well, and we'll maybe get back more into how the engineers would use it. But I think we've probably upset a lot of people today, which is always a good feeling.
That's great.
And Pete, you've been a great guest, actually. I've really enjoyed this, because it's all of this, we're singing from the same hymn sheet on a lot of stuff here, so that's pretty cool.
Nice.
Thank you. Eva, sorry it wasn't as technical as you would normally like.
No problem. It was really interesting for me as well, so thank you for that.
Cool. In that case, we'll close off. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.